When you review the true ideas, after a while, it affects your mind. In other words, like this. First, you should study Ashrei. And you go over the idea till it's clear to the mind. It's thorough to the mind. You see? Then that the mind sees clearly the idea and the benefit of the prayer. Then to affect the emotions, all you need is review of the result. So therefore, you could say, Ashrei, you don't have to go through every step, but because you know the ideas, to help the emotions be affected, you review the results. And that gets you closer to God, because this is the true way of relating to God through God's system. Like, for instance, there are prayers that deal with astronomy and with the different sciences. There are prayers that deal with the nature of a person that God will relate to. It tells you all the information that is necessary to be a person that could relate to God. Now, even though you're not on that level, what I'm saying, prayer can work, that's a special hashkacha, you see? But I'm saying that it could be that the special hashkacha, the reason why God wanted it to work, so that it forces you to go over tefillah and review tefillah. But the benefit of tefillah, the personal benefit, not the prayer that God answers, but the personal benefit, comes about through study of the prayer and understanding the depths of the prayer, and then reviewing the results as much as possible, and through tefillah. That's tefillah. You review the results until it affects the way your emotions look at it, and so then you're totally in line. The total being is in line, total line with God's will. Then when you're spontaneous, like Hannah, when she prayed to have a son, you see, that was spontaneous. Her nature was that she saw that she was able to be spontaneous because that was her nature. She understood everything about it. So then you could be spontaneous. It's like a person that first learns how to drive. You can't be spontaneous in making decisions. But after a few thousand miles, then he's trained. He knows how to make decisions. So then he can make different decisions. We know that Henry Ford accomplish two things. One is he made a car for the plain person. At that time, they only made cars for the rich. He made a simple car for the ordinary person, and for the price, for the ordinary person. Second thing that he created was the assembly line, which made things much easier and much cheaper. So those were the two things he accomplished. Now, the thing is, it seems like that's, tremendous amount of creativity in these two areas to change from what was before. And yet we see in later years when people were discovering new things about the car and making new types of cars, and the public demand was a little different than what Henry Ford had in mind, earlier. I think it was when he first discovered it was around 1910, 1915, around that time, and he had the assembly line. I don't remember the exact date. But anyway, around 1936, 37, he started losing money because he couldn't change. He didn't have the ability to change with the people. In other words, the needs of the people were different, and the other car companies were keeping up with the needs and demands of the public. And so he didn't, he couldn't keep up. He just kept to his old ways. Says my way is the right way, and he would not listen to anybody's advice, and nobody could tell him what to do. In fact, he only had people around him that were basically whatever he said, that's what they did. They carried out just his commands. So the question is, how could a person with that type of personality that can't change could be so creative? Seems to be contradictory. The first possibility that we have is that sometimes people are creative in youth, and they deal with reality and they work it out. But then once they're successful, so that success makes them say that this way is the best possible way, and they can't change with the times. So therefore, they become stubborn, and then they stick to their view based on the past when they were created. But once they become successful, they become attached to that way, and then they can't change. That's the first possibility. Second possibility is like this. There's certain people that their personality operates in a certain way. Now, sometimes that personality fits into reality, and sometimes it doesn't. So sometimes the way you raise, you see things in a certain way, like his thought was for the, like he identified with the farmers, because his parents were farmers. So he identified with the farmers and the farmers' needs. You understand? And his mind was very orderly. So, like he thought in a certain way. So therefore he had the assembly line, and it just so happened that that was the correct time for that to happen. So sometimes people operate in the physical world that they operate according to reality, but however, the reason why they do is not because of reality, but their personality happens to fit into a reality. But as soon as the reality changes, they cannot change their personality according to the change in reality, and that's when they fail. And so therefore, that's the two possibilities in the way Henry Ford, his personality could have evolved in one or two ways, okay, according to the information that we have. Now, the question is let's say, for instance, you see somebody that's harming themselves, somebody you love dearly, and they're living a life where they're doing harm to themselves, overeating, smoking, whatever it may be. And you want to help them out. The question is, how do you go about doing that? Now, the first thing is that you have to understand that the human personality is not a simple thing. You can't tell, do it, straighten yourself out. I mean, that just doesn't work, okay? There are people that smoke and they know smoking is bad. They cannot help it. There are people that drink. There are people that overeat, okay? I mean, I know a couple of people already that they can't help themselves from overeating. They have to go in for an operation to make their stomach smaller, so they're forced to eat less. Or not, they could die. I mean, I'm talking about people weighing 300-400 pounds. Now, why can't... Now, they see the problem. I mean, they're going in for an operation. Why can't they just go on a diet? The answer is that there's certain emotions that are very, very deep. A lot of people, when they say, why can't you just change, I tell them, well, why don't you just stop gossiping? See? Try. Okay? You know, I mean, it's easy to tell other people how to deal with their problems than to face our own problems. And we don't accept the fact that human nature is very, very deep, and a person has to be willing, the first step is he has to be willing to deal with it, and two, he must have the correct knowledge. In other words, like this. There are people that wanted to fly from the time of when Greece was just starting out. You understand? And the people that wanted to fly, we know from stories that they tried different things to fly. But they could not fly until the 1900s, 20th century. Why? Because the thing is that we didn't have the facts. We didn't have the technology to be able to do it. Okay? The same thing is if you want to cure yourself from any type of problem, you must make sure you have the correct answer. If you have an incorrect answer, you're working on an incorrect premise, you'll never cure yourself, and then you'll say, well, why can't I cure myself? I've been working hard on this for 3-4 years and it doesn't work. Well, maybe you have an incorrect view of human nature, and you're approaching it wrong. You don't have the right method. You understand? So the thing is that it's not a simple thing. There's first the desire, but besides the desire, you must have the correct technology, or in this case, the correct understanding of human nature. If you have an incorrect view of human nature, one point off, or if you have a correct view of human nature in general, but you're one point off about yourself, how it applies to yourself, all these things you'll not be able to cure yourself. You could go on for years and it's not going to work. You see? So therefore, there has to be thought out. You can't accept like authority. The mind must see it for itself that it really works and that this is the way to go. You see? And then you can cure yourself. So the same thing when you want to cure others, the most that you could do is try to give them information, and the first thing is they must desire to get this information. They don't want to get the information, then how much you love them, you can't help them. Then if they want to get the information, then you try to make sure you have the correct information and get it across to them. And don't just push it on them, but put it in like terms of a discussion until it becomes clear to them the ideas, and then they could actually use the ideas. In other words, like with raising a child, you could discipline a child in actions. You could punish a child if he doesn't do his homework. You understand, it's an act. But however, dealing with a personality can only be through discussions. You understand? And that's if the child wants to listen. The child, or you have to find a way to reach the child that to cause him to want to listen. You see? But you cannot just force a person to listen, and you cannot change a personality just by sheer force. You could control an act. That doesn't mean you're changing it. You could control the act, but changing the personality that the child should want to change the act, that takes a very slow process through the same way we run our classes. That is the exact same way you would raise the child. Now the question is, does the different self-help groups that we have, like Alcoholics Anonymous or other types of groups, these self-help groups, do they work? The answer is that they have somebody in the group that's able to see beneath the surface and explain the motives on a conscious level, then it could work. I'll give you an example. We had a class one time, and I had some of the best students in the school. I mean, these were students, boys and girls, that they were doing straight A work, some of them valedictorians, besides which they were either running organizations, other organizations, or the school organizations, or they were into sports. I mean, they had all the time for all these things, plus get 4 O's on and become valedictorians. Some of them were pretty close. I mean, talk about top students. But yet when we would discuss that you should sit down to study and start working on your own, they had a tremendous difficulty. And we're trying to understand the nature of the difficulty. And basically, we came up with two areas that is possible. I'm not saying this is the only area. You might be able to add to this. The first area that we said is that there's certain people that can only work in a certain situation, and their situation where they operate the best is in a classroom situation where there's an authority. They're told what to do, and then they do the work. But they can't self-motivate themselves without that authority telling them what to do, and then being tested on it and checked out. They can't do it if it's for their own benefit to do it. They can't do it. In other words, just to do it for their own benefit, they can't do it. That was one problem. The other problem is some people have a fear of making mistakes. Now, in school, you memorize what they say, or sometimes you have to do a little creative stuff. but it's still being checked over. And the thing is that most of the stuff is just like memorization or doing research and writing what other people said. A lot of the stuff is just, I don't have to be creative on my own. Now here I'm reading a genius and I have to make sure, like the commentaries, or even when you, like if you're studying the sciences, reading abstract thinkers, you're not even sure what they're saying because they have a different way of writing. You can make mistakes. So there's a fear of making mistakes, you see. And therefore, they're afraid to work on their own because of this fear of mistakes. The truth is, you can't operate without making mistakes. Therefore, Judaism holds from repentance that you should repent and you made a mistake. So as you continue, if you have people to talk it over with, you can get straightened out. And then you move on and you straighten yourself out and you keep moving. But the thing is, those were the two emotions that we came up with. Now, if this is not very deep, you see, then by analyzing this and being aware of which one is stopping you, that by reviewing it and looking at it from different angles, then that could help you undo the emotion. Of course, if the emotion is very deep, then that is not enough. It's deeper than that, then that is not enough, and you got to go further. But the thing is, what I'm saying is that these groups can work if there's somebody that could define the problems in exactly the way that we just did. You see? So then you can cure yourself on the conscious level. If it is too deep, even if you find the correct emotion, then it will not help you. Then you have to do further. Probably you'd have to do an actual analysis. So the thing is that's what I have to say about these group therapies, whether they work or not. Whether they work or not depends on how clear the leader is to define the problem clearly and to be able to present it to the group. Then I think it can work. Now, there's some people that go to these groups, and within the group, they're able to lose weight, but on their own, they can't. The reason for that is the exact problem that we're just talking about. Some people can only work within a framework of authority. And so, therefore, this group becomes the authority or the person that weighs them in or talks to them. These people become the authority and they could work within that framework. And therefore, it's very possible that the person that's leading it is not reaching out to the mind, but is reaching out to that emotion which causes them to work as a group. And then they will keep them dependent on the group for the rest of their lives if they can lose weight in that situation. But they can never work out of that situation because they become dependent on that group situation to be able to operate, you see. So therefore, sometimes it could work not because of the true ideas, but because that people could only work in the group situation, and therefore that helps them in that situation. So for the rest of their lives, they'd have to be in that situation.
So it becomes part of the emotion.
The question is like this, that sometimes in these groups, they don't have a leader, okay? They just have people that just come together to express their needs or express their problems or express however they're feeling about the particular group, what the group is working on, all right? Now, the thing is that just expressing it is a immediate release of tension. But however, it's not a long-term cure, and it also could be that the group becomes, even though there's no leader, the group becomes the leader. The group becomes the authority figure, the group itself, or the validation of what you're doing. What I'm saying is that like the problem with people that, just the facts are, that people that work very well in a classroom situation, or people that lose weight in a certain group cannot lose weight on their own when they leave the group. Okay? Now, what I'm saying, what you should do is to define the problem exactly what we said. There are certain people that could study one way, they can't study another. Question is, why? You see? So we defined two problems that it could be. Either they can only work in a group, we defined that clearly to the mind, or two, they're afraid of making a mistake. Okay? Now when we define it, then they have the information that now they could think consciously about their problem. So every time they sit down to study, they suddenly feel that they can't do it, then they start thinking about that emotion. When they're being stopped, they could think about the emotion and work through the emotion by the knowledge that they have and watch the causes of what's causing them. One student might see that it's because they have a fear of making a mistake. Another student might see that it's the other kind, but they have to go through consciously again and again, whenever the emotion is awakened, consciously what the cause is, and to think it through, not memorization, not just repeating it like you just repeat something. But the mind must see that this is the cause why they can't do it, and by reviewing it every time they're in that situation, that will cure them. That is, in my view, the conscious method of curing yourself. You see? That is the first step that a person should take when they run into trouble in the physical world. Okay. It says in the in Sajigan's introduction to Mishle, he says that there are two basic drives of every human being: desire for pleasure and the avoidance of pain. Are there any others? It's supposed to include everything. But the thing is, he says, there are two areas in which these could be carried out. In other words, it could be carried out in the immediate or in the future. Okay? In other words, I have a immediate desire right now, and I carry out the desire. Or I have immediate desire now, and in other words, let's give an example. In other words, let's say a person smokes, so he has immediate pleasure. But however, in the future, he has pain, right? Or if a person goes in for surgery, so immediately he has pain. But then later on, if the surgery was a success, so then he has pleasure. So he says that you always have to evaluate the immediate versus the long term. He says this is an introduction to Mishle. Now, the person that acts upon the long term, you see, that person is called a chacham. That is what the Mishle calls a chacham,
which is translated as a wise person.
As a wise person, that's correct. Chacham is a wise person. Now the question is, why is this a wise person? Okay. The answer is that there is a, in other words, like this. Immediately, I have a desire to smoke. Immediately, I have a desire not to have surgery, to avoid surgery at all costs, okay, because of all the pain it causes. But however, my mind tells, but that's, I'm experiencing right now, those feelings I'm experiencing. But the idea of the future, that in the future I'll have pleasure from the surgery or pain from the smoking, that I'm not experiencing, that I only know with my mind. So when I'm able to make a decision based on my mind over my experience of my immediate emotion right now, therefore we call you a chacham. I'll try to explain it from another angle. They had advertisements about cigarettes, that cigarettes cause cancer. Never worked. Or worked very little. But however, then they started drawing pictures, showing pictures of the inside of the human being and death. Actual pictures of people dying and all these pictures. Now the first one, the reason why it was not successful is because it was dependent on your mind. Because they only told you the idea. And the other one is dependent on the five senses. You see? So you see that where it's dependent on the mind, naturally the person does not think of even though he knows the information, it's not real enough to overcome his immediate desire. You see, that takes a certain amount of training. That's the book of Mishle to help you train. In other words, like this. We have a certain sense of reality. That sense of reality attaches to my five senses or to that which is very close to my five senses. Like, for instance, I asked the class if they're given a test that it's going to be in a month, let's say, when do they start getting the jitters that they have to start studying? Now, the biggest thinker said 2 days. One said 1 day. One said the night before. One said in the morning or lunch before the test. In other words, depending, you know what I mean? So when you get close to the physical situation, that's the closer you get, it becomes more real to you. But it's never real to you the month before. That is the book of Mishle, where your sense of reality is extended from the five senses, and we try to extend it to the world of ideas, that it becomes so real that it could overcome your immediate experience and your immediate feeling of that emotion. And you also see this in Pirkei Avos, where it says, Ezu Chacham Haroes Anolad. Who is the wise man? He who sees the future. This statement is really incorrect. Why? Because a wise person does not see the future. He knows the future. A prophet sees the future. So therefore, it's incorrect what he's saying.
So
the question is, what does it mean, see? So he wants to say that it's so real to the person that it's as if he sees it in his mind, it's as if he sees it now, and that's how real it is, and that means that he has extended his sense of reality from his five senses to the world of ideas. Now how you get this is by not only studying Mishle, but by reviewing it as many times as possible. Now, there is a difference between review and memorization. Okay? Memorization I bypass the mind, and therefore I don't understand it any better than the first time I memorized it. Well, the first time I went over it and the 100th time I went over it, there's absolutely no difference. While review means that I go over it as if it's the first time, then there is a difference how I see it. There's a difference between the 100th time and the 101st time, or the 200th time or the 201st time. There's absolutely a difference every time you go over it. The only problem is that most people are not trained to review, and that takes training to review itself takes training, that the mind can continuously go over an idea and constantly see new ideas in it. But until you get there, then you can only review it until you just run out of steam. You're like, you can't do it anymore. And that's it. So then you have to stop and move to the next verse. But however, if you can, review is a good thing. And learning more is also a good thing, because you see it, the same idea from different angles. So learning many verses is also a good thing. So both are good. You really need both. But there should not be a desire to finish. Finish is not needed. It's to review. Each point must become real to you. You must see it. The mind must see it clearly and review it. Even though you know it, and you'll see new things in it, it'll become clearer until it affects your very personality. That's how you get to become a chacham. The question is, like halacha, I have to accept halacha, even if I don't understand it. Let's say I accept the pasuk in Mishlei, I accept King Solomon is right, but I really don't understand it. Then you must say that it's not affecting you, because the only way a Mishlei can affect you is through understanding. It is different than halacha. Halacha, I'm obligated to obey God and do an act. So I do the act whether I understand it or not. But here I'm trying to affect the way I think. I cannot affect the way I think unless I truly understand the idea. And if I don't truly understand the idea and I accept it, then it's not affecting me. Then that pasuk or whatever I'm learning, if I just accept that I trust King Solomon, then that will not affect me in my studies. And what we're talking about, that every verse you must understand, and when reviewed, the mind must see every step. Okay, it's no memorization and no acceptance. That will not affect you. And halacha, that's the way you have to do it, whether you understand it or not. You ask the rabbi says, this is what the rabbi says, jump, you ask how high. That's it. Okay? But however, in Mishlei, it's not like that. In Mishlei, it affects you only through the understanding. And now we're going to chapter 15, verse 31. And it says, an ear that hears. The tachacha is a musar, or a type of training of this type of thought. He says, among the wise he rests. He will dwell among the wise. Okay, a person that hears these type of ideas, he dwells among the wise. Okay? Now, Rabbeinu Yonah on that verse says, that he says just like it is fitting and proper that they for thinkers in the studies of science and the study of ideas Talmud, not Musar, other than Musar, right, they give and take, they have debates and discussions, and they sit, anybody that desires that will sit among the wise. He says, so it is fitting to sit among the wise, those that listen to Musar, because the Chachamim desire and are happy in being with them. Now listen carefully what he adds. He says, even though they don't have the ability to grasp and understand chachma, meaning science, or gemara, the study of God, I mean certain abstract ideas, but still in all, they are honored in their eyes, since they understand the words of tachacha, the words of Musar, and they desire to listen to them. So the thing is that you see, in other words, what he's saying, what the Rabbeinu Yonah says, is that Musar is a study that's not very abstract. It's not an abstract science. Okay? Now, it is. In Torah, of all the studies in Torah, Musar is the least abstract. The question was how we define Musar. We'll come to the definition of Musar soon. Okay? But anyway, because we're just dealing with the Chacham now, insofar as Chachma of Musar is concerned. Okay? So therefore, a person that just, even though he doesn't have the ability to study the sciences, he doesn't have the ability to study Halacha, which is a very abstract science. I'll give you an example. There are commentaries like Tosfos, Rashba, Ramban, that are on Talmud that are more abstract than any verse in Mishlei. And yet Mishlei was written by the greatest genius that ever lived. You see? Now, how is it possible that these people could be more abstract than King Solomon? The answer is that the subject doesn't lend itself to that level of abstraction. There is abstraction, and there is you have to become a thinker, but it's not that level of abstraction. You see? So he says, even if a person only has the ability to study Musa, to study Mishlei, he can't study anything else. You see? So then he is accepted because he can't get into discussions, abstract discussions. He is already in the club. He's accepted in the club of wise people. Moshe Rabbeinu will accept him in the club of wise people. You see? Because once you extend your sense of reality to the world of ideas, that is the basic definition of a chacham. There are many thinkers that think abstract ideas, and they're great scientists, and they're known for the abstract, but yet they're not wise. We will not consider them wise, you see? And we will take a person, we might enjoy talking in science with them and getting the ideas of science, but however, we would accept more a person that has his mind, whatever he does see, even though he doesn't have the ability to see more, we would accept him as a chacham as long as his sense of reality, what his mind sees, becomes real to him, and he understands what that is. Now it says in chapter 10, verse 13, it says, in the mouth of the thinker you will find wisdom. Okay? And Rashi says, when a man rebukes a navon, a thinker, or what we say a chacham, he answers to him, I sinned. Just like David said to Nasan, I sinned. The story was that David lived with Bathsheba, and Nasan came to tell him. He gave a metaphor like this. He says there was a very rich person. He tells David, he's telling him as a true story. David thought this was a true story. And he says, Nasan told him, he says there was a very wealthy man, has flocks of sheep, and next door was a poor man who only had one sheep. He says, but the rich man was going to make a party, but he was so stingy, he couldn't take sheep from his own flock for his party, so he stole the sheep of the poor man, and he made a party with it. David gets very angry, he gets off his chair, he says, tell me who this man is. And Nathan says, you see? And he's taken aback. There's a few spaces there. There's a few asterisks between. And then after that, he says, Chatasi, I sinned. You see? So the thing is, we would like to define the difference between the term here for the wise person is used as a navon. Difference between a navon and a chacham in Musar. Okay? Both the word navon and chacham means wise. Okay? The question is, what's the difference? Okay? Let's say, for instance, let's go back to a person taking a test. Okay? So he's told that he's going to have to take a test in a month. Okay? Now, a chacham will think it through, and he will spend time thinking it through for a day or two, until it becomes real to him that the test is really going to happen. And he doesn't have to wait for the last minute, but however his mind sees it after a while, thinking it through, so So the Chacham makes it real to him, to himself, and so he could carry out the act of starting to study now. A Navon is where he's put in a situation that immediate response. He has to make an immediate response. That the Chacham might fail in such a situation, because his nature is not to respond immediately to the world of ideas. He needs time to think it through until it becomes real to him. The Navon, however, is on a higher level where he's affected, where the mind takes over immediately, and the immediate emotion does not play any role in his decision making. In other words, here a person comes into, in other words, it'd be like this. Somebody would come over to you and say, "How could you do such a stupid act? Are you crazy?" And they tell you the act, and I've never heard a person say, "You know, you're right, I did a stupid act." You ever hear a person say that? I mean, right? Nobody ever says that. You see, David HaMelech has the ability to do that. That's another, okay? But you might think that you have to be a King David to reach that. The answer is, no, this is written in Mishlei. This is part of Musar, whatever the definition of Musar is, which we'll come to. Okay? But however, this is Musar, which is not very abstract. And therefore, it's for a person that's not as abstract as King David. But he must have, through the study of Musar, he has a strong sense of reality, so to such an extent that even if you tell him off in the worst emotional situation, a powerful emotion, he will still make a decision to do that which is intelligent and right. Okay? The Chacham can't. The Chacham, he has extended it, but it's not the sense of reality is extended to his mind, but it's not as strong as the Navon. The Navon is, and he can make a rational decision on the spur of the moment, in the second. His mind naturally works that way. So I'm just trying to tell you the different levels of what this, insofar as a wise person is concerned, insofar as Musa is concerned, what the wise person is and what levels you can reach with this. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, everybody knows that if you have light skin and you go on the sun the first day of the summer, you could be in real trouble. You could get a burn. You might have to go to the hospital. And they know a simple thing. All you have to do is put on sunblock. Now, how many people get sunburns at the first day of the summer? There are many, right? See, they know that you could get a sunburn. But it's not real to them. They don't think about the pain. I mean, I know kids come into school after the first day of a good sunny day, and you can't touch their back. They got sunburn. Now, don't they know to protect themselves? Don't they realize the pain they're going to have? Of course, but it's not real to them. The immediate is, I just want to do what I feel like doing. You see? In other words, many people can calculate, like, for instance, I'll give you an example. To a businessman, he could calculate all all the consequences. Some of the very good businessmen could figure out all the consequences of his actions in business. But how to relate to his wife and how to relate to his kids and how to deal with any other area of life that he doesn't know. It's not real to him. Just business. Just one aspect is real to him. Other areas he won't do it. But it's not real to him. You see? So the thing is that we're saying that life has to be analyzed. Life itself, everyday living, every decision you make has to be analyzed. There are some people, like a businessman, he might be able to calculate the future in business. He's a chacham in business. But however, in everyday life, how he deals with everyday life, he doesn't operate that way. So if you do not try to deal with, like study Mishlei and consciously work on it, then who you are is a matter of your personality, what you're born with. If you're a chacham in a certain area, you'll be a chacham. Some people become a chacham in many areas. I don't know why have a certain sense of reality, you know what I mean? And it just extends out to other areas, okay? But, however, most people are not going to be that way, and either they won't be a chacham in any area, or they'll be a chacham in one particular area. Some people are chachamim like they really could work out like in motors, you see, they work out every single detail. They're really good mechanics, like in a car. To fix a car, they're really good mechanics. They could see every knock and noise that they hear. They know how to interpret and how to work it and what to do, you see. But however, when it comes to making decisions, there are many people that were great, like architects or painters or even in sports. They made millions of dollars, but yet they weren't smart in money making and they lost their money. Mark Twain lost all his money, made stupid investments. You understand? The guy was a very bright guy, an intelligent guy. You understand? He was a thinker in many areas. You read some of his works, but yet when it came to business, it was like his mind was totally closed and made stupid areas, stupid mistakes. So the thing is that the study of Mishle doesn't leave it to chance, but it will help you open your mind to all areas of thought that has to do with your personal life, that has to do with making decisions in your personal life and how to make decisions about yourself. That is the subject of Mishle. In other words, there's a difference between that which is outside of your ability. Like if you were in the World Trade Center on September 11th, so that's out of your hands, that a plane is going to fly in. I mean, you can't figure on that. But we're talking about what's in the ability of the human being with the fact that he has, that he can make correct decisions. Like somebody said he feels bad, something bad happened. I said, yeah, but you made when you were making the decision, you didn't have these facts. That's all you could do. He says, yeah, that's true. He says, but I still feel bad. But the fact is that he made a certain decision based on the information he had. It was a correct decision. And then it worked out differently that decision was not a good decision, wasn't the best decision. But the thing is, so that you can't help. If you don't have the information, that you can't help. You have to look back, whether you can condemn yourself, you have to look back on the original situation when you were making the decision. When something goes wrong, you see? So then you go back to the original decision and see if you could have figured it out. If you couldn't have figured it out, then you have to correct it. That's how you start correcting yourself. You say that if I could have figured it out, then what stopped me from figuring it out? So then I have to think about it and figure out that. But if I could not figure it out, and there's nothing to do. I couldn't figure it out. That's out of my hands. That's prayer. See, that's when we turn to God. We do everything we can to the best of our ability, but then when it's out of our hands, you see, then that's what we turn to God for. That's what prayer is. Prayer is not for what we can do. Prayer is for what we cannot do.
Rabbi?
In other words, I pray to God for those areas that I cannot do for myself, so I turn to God that He should help me out there because I can't do it. As a human being, I can't do it. So I pray to Him. But however, where I could do it, then He will not help me. Because I could do it myself. You could do it yourself, then do it yourself.
What?
Now the question is, what is Musar? We defined what a Chacham, and we showed what a Navon is, in Musar, but however, we have not defined what Musar is. In chapter 1, verse 2, it says to know wisdom and Musar. And the Rabbah has two commentaries, one on the subject and one on he translates words. And he translates the word Musar. So let's listen to what the Rabbah says in his Bir Amilos, in his explanation of words, what he says about Musa. He says, there are two types of Musa. Musa is Musa of traits, and there's Musa of ideas. Okay? Now, the Musa of traits is to leave bad and and harmful traits, and to practice traits that are of importance and benefit. And the mitzvah of ideas is to train yourself in understanding according to their order and according to their path, that it flows to them. In other words, your studies flow, and you shouldn't look in what it is not the path to reach. You cannot reach the mind. The mind can't understand. But you should not shorten from looking into things that which is possible for man to understand. So we have to define these two types of mussar. Okay? Now, when we take the traits, your personality leads to certain actions. Okay? Now, therefore, when you do incorrect actions based on some wrong emotion, an incorrect emotion, in other words, like if you save money beyond that which is reasonable, so then you have to work on your trait of stingy and undo stinginess. However, if you develop generosity, you understand, so then as long as the generosity doesn't go beyond which is your means. Some people become so generous, it's not generosity, it's foolishness, that they give away all their money. We're not talking about that. Generosity means that I have for myself and I give to others. And it's worked out exactly where it is. That's generosity. But too far, too little is no good. So that is the... And so therefore, the trait is really a certain attitude towards life. It's a certain attitude that leads to behavior. Okay? So if you have a certain... Your attitude is one way... So then, I'll give you an example to explain, a comparison. In halacha, let's say, for instance, a charity, right? Now, let's say there are three types of people. There's one person that he gives charity, but he enjoys the glory that he gets when he gives it, that everybody honors him. There's another person that's very stingy, and he gives charity, but he's always in conflict every time he gives charity. Then there's a person that's so stingy that he can't give charity. You see? Now, the first two, the training in mussar will simply remove the pain. In other words, one is remove an incorrect attitude that I'd only do it for honor, you see? Or to attract people to look at, to look special at me and give me honor, right? The other is I'm in conflict. If I do the correct act, but I'd have to change my attitude towards the act. So when I change my attitude towards the act, so then I am perfecting what we call perfecting my soul, because I'm doing the correct act, and now I have to perfect my soul to get the correct attitude, so that the behavior is done in a proper manner, in the correct framework in which we should operate in Torah. The third person that we mention is not doing the correct act. So he or she has to start working on stinginess to at least lower the level, even if he can't undo it, but to lower the level enough so that he could give charity. You see? All these three areas are areas of mussar, and how they relate to halacha. It's also how it relates to everyday life too. We have a problem with life, so therefore you must look at the trait and see how that trait is affecting you and how to change the trait and to change it over to be able to be more realistic and have a more realistic view of life. That is the mussar of trait. Now we go to the mussar of ideas. Okay? Now he doesn't tell you how to learn. He says mussar is not teaching you how to learn, how to investigate. telling you what to investigate. What? What should you investigate? So there are certain people, again, there are two attitudes towards learning itself. That's what he means by Musa of ideas. The same, Musa changes attitudes, and it changes attitudes that lead to different behaviors. One is in actions, and one is thinking. That he subdivides it between, it's really attitudes of different actions, but it's actions of everyday life, and then there's actions, what he means by actions, and an attitude about thinking. Okay? There's some attitudes that, like in the United States, you have in school that if you start the book, you have to finish the book, you know what I mean? You have to complete the book. We say that that's an incorrect attitude towards study. Okay? That will destroy your thinking process because you have to skip steps, jump, even if you don't understand it. You got to accept things, got to memorize things just for a test. That's a bad attitude. That trains you to a bad attitude. The correct attitude is not to finish, but to understand. Only according to your speed. One idea understood is more important than 100 ideas that are not clear. And therefore, he says, you should study so that it should flow. Like, it's so simple. You review it many times until, like, yeah, it's so simple. You see? But, however, you have to be very careful not to go into areas that you're not ready for. Because if you go into an area that you're not ready for, to understand that you're going to have to skip steps and have wrong assumptions about the subject, which means it will not be clear to you, and it'll harm your mind because you're thinking, forcing yourself to think incorrectly. Says the only correct attitude towards study, you see, is that you should only want to get clarity in the idea that you can understand. And everything that you can understand, you want to get clarity, but no rush. Do each thing separately, step by step, until it is clear to you. Each step by itself is 100% clear. So therefore, his definition of Musa is attitudes which affect your behavior, you see? And since it's attached to behavior, it's not necessarily very abstract. When you're dealing with physics, it has to do with the universe. It's going to be very abstract, you see. But the study is only related to attitudes of behavior, you see. And therefore, that's what Musa is, according to the Ramban. And therefore, if you study Musa, so then you will have the correct attitude in life and the correct attitude in study, and that type of study will help you find, it will get Musa even better, and then you will have the good life. It says, in Perek Yud, chapter 10, verse 23, says, it's like a joke for a fool to do evil. And then it's like a joke is attached to the second half of the verse also, and he says, it's like a joke for a wise person to do wise things, do intelligent things. So Rashi says, Rashi is the one that says, Chachma kischok le'ish tevuna. Wisdom is like a joke to a man of understanding. In other words, it becomes very, very simple, you see. The thing is that when you start out in this area of wisdom in Musa, in other words, the definition of wisdom for Chachma in Musar is different than the definition of Chachma in other studies. You see? There, Chachma is like science. So sometimes you have to know what a person, or if you're reading something, what he is saying when he uses the term Chacham. Sometimes he uses the word Chacham, it means he's a scientist. And he's studying abstract ideas, even in Talmud, studying abstract ideas. But however, Musa Chacham is the where he extends his sense of reality to the world of ideas. So therefore, it could affect the world of ideas too, and science could affect, because science also, when you study science, there's certain attitudes towards science. Like, for instance, certain people study science, and they study, like Einstein, he found the God, and he studied the physics. Certain people that study physics says, look how smart man is. You see, look how smart we are. I mean, years ago, they didn't understand anything. Look how far we reached. Look how great man is. Look what he did. The airplanes and things, what he did, and the mind and the levels that he reached. So therefore, there's different attitudes, even in science. So science, the study of science, also could show you different attitudes or not, you see. So therefore, in science also, if you have Musa, it will affect your attitude. The result of the study of science could affect your attitude about life itself. But anyway, back to our pasuk. His dad says, because you force me to face things I don't want to face. You see? So in that way, she's right. In other words, when you talk about Musa and you educate a person about Musa, it runs contrary to their personality. It has to. Because the natural beginning personality is a foolish, in other words, whatever you happen to be. But you have to make changes, so at the beginning it becomes very hard. But once it becomes second nature and you think this way, it is the easiest thing in the world to be a chacham. It becomes the easiest thing in the world. But that takes a twist, a certain change in your personality, as changing from the what Mishle would call the fool, and changing to the chacham, where you start seeing things based on ideas. You see, so that's a totally different person. That takes a development of becoming a chacham and musar, because you must go contrary to your personality to accomplish it. And so musar is a training. This training, in other words, the switch that we're talking about here, is a training for in attitudes towards the wisdom. First, your attitude towards wisdom, it's very hard and difficult, and you don't want to go to it. It's easier to follow your old ways. But then once you make the switch, it becomes very easy. The new attitude is plus second nature to you. Then it's very easy to be a chacham. So in other words, you shouldn't think that if it's difficulty at the beginning to start, that it's going to be difficult your whole life. It's only difficult until you make the switch. Once you make the switch, then you're in good shape. I'd like to clarify about King David, what happened there, when he just said chatasi, I sinned. When on the spur of the moment he saw his mistake, so I'd like to explain what that is, what happened there. when somebody tells you off, the first thing it hits is your ego. So therefore, you either yell back or you become defensive and protect yourself. You cannot look at the subject objectively, you see. Because you're still, in other words, because you still look at life through your emotions, even though you are a chacham, but you still look at life through your emotions to a certain extent. So therefore, I mean, you are a chacham, it extended, and you can work it out. But in even that situation, maybe let's say somebody would tell you off, and a half hour later, when you calm down, you could think it through, and you could say, "Oh, you're right." A lot of people can't. Most people can't do that either, even afterwards. But the first step is that a chacham still has a certain level of self to him that comes first, so that when you are told off, you see, so that thing's coming first, and then you could think it out later when it's a little less painful, you could start thinking it over. If you're not a chacham, you will never think it over at all. The navon never looks at things personally. You tell him off, he just looks at it objectively. Is that statement true or false? It has nothing to do with the self. It's not a personal, it's not a personal insult. There's no personal insult. It's not that there's no self. You still have a personality. There's something there. But it's no ego, and you look at it objectively in reality. What is the man saying? You say, is it true or false? That's it.
That is
King David. That's a nava. See, that's a nava. In other words, we're defining the difference between both a chacham and a nava is his sense of reality has extended to the world of ideas. The question is there any ego left to deny when somebody tells you off? So the thing is the chacham, you tell him off, he might react like any fool, like his old self will react. But however, an hour later or 2 hours later, he'll think it through and say, you know, the guy was right. While a person that's not a chacham will not even think it through. He won't even know that there is something to think through. He'll even hold on to his anger. Okay, and stay angry with the person. The Navon at that point has no ego at all. And when you tell him off, he just looks at it, is it right or wrong? When David HaMelech jumped back, it was not because of ego, it was because he needed a few seconds to see if what Nosson was saying is right and how it affected him. You know what I mean? How the idea is, was it me that lived that life? That I did that? And he says, yes, I did. You see? But it was only, he needed time to think it through. But until he thought it through. But that's what Rashi is saying, what a Navon is.
Thank you.
The question is, what does it mean, Elu ve'elu, Divrei Elokim Chayim? Both are the words of the living God. Whenever there's a disagreement between our sages, so even though they have opposite opinions, we still say both are the words of the living God. And the question is, how is such a thing possible that both could be what God said? All right, so the answer is that first of all, the statement Elu ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim is only applied to halacha. It's not applied to philosophy or hashkafa. Because in that area, they're dealing with reality, and only one could be right. Both can't be right. So only one could be right. So you can't say both are the words of the living God if one is definitely wrong. But however, in halacha, what happens is that, in other words, like this, God that gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. As it was passed down, something went wrong, and there became two opinions. There's no way of getting these opinions back. Okay? So we don't know which one God said on Mount Sinai, but we have to live by one of them. Now, it is possible that we're living by one which God didn't say. And yet, I must live by that, even if Moshe came down and said through prophecy that I never said that, we would not be able to listen to him. In other words, because it is in the hands of our sages to decide what is halacha. It must be based on a system, not a prophecy, but that which was passed down. And therefore you see that it's God's will that we should maintain the system. In other words, God wants Israel to maintain the system which he gave originally. And therefore, when we have to maintain it, of course there's going to be certain errors. And therefore, when there are errors, So we won't be living exactly like what God said on Mount Sinai, but that's God's will, that we should maintain and live by the system based on our own wisdom, not on prophecy. Okay? The only thing is, you also, I'm not saying that it's more important to maintain the system than doing what God said. What we are saying is that God wants us to maintain the system. That is God's will, that He wants us to maintain the system the best that is possible. Because God, as much as possible, wants us to be responsible for our actions. Like, for instance, God will not perform a miracle unless we did everything possible. Like, for instance, there's a medrash that says that Moshe Rabbeinu came down to when he came down to the Red Sea, so he says, God, help me. You know, he turned to God, and God said to him, now is not the time to pray, now is the time to act. Then a man by the name of Nachshon ben Aminadav jumped into the water up until his nose. He says, God, one more step and I drown, and then the water split. So you see from our sages that our sages hold that we're always, God wants us to be responsible for our actions as much as is humanly possible. And only after that does God intervene. And so therefore with our halachic system also, God wants us to maintain the system and take responsibility for that system. However, the thing is that the system can never be totally lost, even though it's given into the hands of man. You might think that, well, it could wind up, totally lost. The answer is, if you look back through all the arguments and disagreements that our sages had, the Maratz Chayas points out that only details have been lost. In other words, there is no disagreement, there's no machlokas about tefillin being black. There's no machlokas about tefillin being square. There's no machlokas about that the tefillin of the head, of the shel rosh, has four compartments. There's no machlokas what is written in the four parchments that go into the four compartments. There is a machlokas in the order, in what order you put it. You see? So the thing is that you see that it's the machlokas comes out in details, but the basic system was never lost. So for instance, it was never lost that you're not allowed to make a knot on Shabbos. But however, what's the definition of a knot? That became a machlokas. That became a difference of opinion. But the basic system is always there, but certain details, the arguments came about in certain details. The question is whether when the Messiah comes, whether all the disagreements will be resolved. I hope that what the Messiah will do, I don't have a proof, but what makes sense is that he'll set up a Sanhedrin. He'll set up a Supreme Court, and all the difference of opinions will be voted on. Wherever we don't have a real decision, a real psak, then the court will make a psak, because that's God's will, that we should maintain the system according to the way man worked it out. And so therefore, I think all we'll do is vote on it, and there'll be, instead of having different communities living by different laws, the whole nation will live by one system. Because you see also in the Gemara it says that when Moshe died, they mourned for Moshe for 30 days. And they lost, I think, 2,000 laws. What it means, like I told you, a difference of opinion of what the laws are, the details. And the story in the Gemara says that Yeshua went to God and asked to give him the laws. And God said, Lo ba'ashamayim, it's not in heaven. laws were only given originally from heaven, but it's not in heaven anymore. It's not for heaven to decide on these systems. I don't think at the time of the Messiah there should be any difference, and therefore the Sanhedrin again will vote on, and it'll just be a uniform system instead of now we have different communities following different sages, so they act differently. But however, when the Messiah comes, we'll all act according to one system based on the Sanhedrin, or the Supreme Court of Israel. The question is, it says, Shivim Panim La Torah. There are 70 faces to Torah. Okay? Which means there are many, many different ways of interpreting Torah. And the question is, I mean, God wrote one Torah, should have one meaning, and how could it have 70 meanings? What do you mean it has 70 different meanings? I mean, it has one meaning. Should have. It's God's reality. It should be only one meaning. So an example is by Samuel, by Shmuel Aleph, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph. It says, Imro Sire Ba'ani Amosecha. If you see in the, it says a double language of see. You see the affliction of your maidservant, right? It says a double language of see. Now, the Radak mentions that, that it could be that sometimes it's just natural that the verse uses a double see. But our sages say that if you don't give me a child, so he says, I'll get my husband jealous, and he'll tell me not to see this certain man, and then I'll go in privacy with this man, and nobody will see what happens, but they will see that I went into privacy with this man, and then I will become a sota. I'll be obligated to drink from the water. A certain mixture that they made, and since I didn't sin, the reward for because I was embarrassed publicly, in the Torah it says that I can't have children, I will have children. So he says, Hannah says to God, either give me a child, or I'll put myself in a situation where you'll have to give me a child. Okay? In other words, according to our sages, Hannah is blackmailing God, saying, either do it my way, or I'll force you to do it according to your own system. Okay? But that's definitely not written in the Pasuk. It's just an interpretation based on an extra C that you see. Okay, so it's not really in the Torah, but it's another interpretation that could fit in the Torah. That was verse Yud Aleph 4:11. Well, the question is, which one did God say? Let's say, I mean, many times it's even more obvious to Medrash. There's two ways of interpreting a pasuk. And one is closer to the explanation, one is further from the explanation. There are different ways of explaining the same verse. And how could they all be true? God only said one of them. God could have only meant one of them. How could he mean all these different interpretations? The purpose of Torah is to tell us all the situations in which God, the way God relates to us, and the way we should relate to God. Okay? And therefore, every case that we get makes it clearer to us different information about relating to God. Now, the verse, if I look at the verse, it says if you pray to God, you know how to pray correctly, so then God will listen to you. That's one idea. In fact, we learn many, many laws about prayer from the way Chana prayed. But our sages say there is another idea that can also be learned, and they fit it into the verse, but it's another aspect of our relationship to God. And that is that God relates to us based on a system. Just like in the laws of nature, you could work things out based on if you know the laws of nature. In other words, years ago, a few centuries ago, they wanted something to change, to control the universe, they prayed to God. I mean, I'm not talking about Judaism, there is a way of praying to God, but I'm talking about idolatry. That was the way the whole world went. They brought sacrifices based on nothing, and it did not succeed. They did not control the world. But however, when scientists came about, and they started understanding the world and how it works, so they were able to create new things until today. You know, we could fly, we go to the moon. So the thing is that since we know the system, so we can use the system for our benefit. Now the same thing with Hashgacha Pratis, God's personal supervision, the same thing is if you know exactly the way God works, then you can use the system to satisfy your needs. You see? So, like for instance, you'll notice not only, so therefore that's what our sages are saying. And they're adding, in other words, it's saying that even in, and if you look at the verse, you'll see that the verse is in a certain sense also saying that, because Chana says that I'll donate this son, if you give me a son, I have a need for a son. She had a need to have a child. She says, and if I have a child, I'll donate him to God, meaning that when Shmuel was 2 years old, he was sent to live in a dorm, basically. He was sent to the Beis HaMikdash to study under Eli the Kohen. Okay? So the thing is, she really gave up a child to God in that way. So we see that to get God to listen to us, our prayers should be put in such a way that God, the way God relates to us, not from our own, not the way we look at life. I'll give you an example. Let's say, for instance, in Shemona Esrei, in the standing prayer, it says that different things we ask for God. We ask health, wealth, wisdom, and a few other things. Okay? Now, that's one way of praying. I say, God, give me these things. Or I could look at it and say that God is the only one that can give it to me. Even if I work on my own, there's no guarantee that I'll get it. I'm responsible to work on my own. I have responsibility to do everything I can. But however, at a certain point, I need God's help. So therefore, I say to God, you are the only one that you have the ability. So I recognize God's abilities, and that helps me reach a higher level because I'm recognizing God. And therefore, through that, I can get what I want. That's the way prayer works. So the thing is that you have to put it in a different framework, in the framework of God's system. And when you know God's system, then your prayers and the way you operate and the way you relate to God, because you have the right to use the system to relate to God. And so anyway, to answer the question of 70 faces of Torah, means sometimes there is a different situation that can be pointed out, and we could learn something new from that situation. that we have a right to use the system, you understand, God's system, and that success comes about by understanding the system. When you understand God's system and then use the system and pray according to the system, then you can be successful. But however, but you could also use the system in the other way. Like you could say, I'll do an act and go in private with this man, then you'll obligate me to drink the concoction. I mean, that's also using the system in a different way. But what our sages are saying, you have a right through the study of the system then to use the system to reach God, because that will help you also get closer to God, because you understand God's system. That's really getting closer to God by understanding God's system. So then you know how, once you know God's system, then you know how to relate to God. But that's the but that's what it means, 70 faces to Torah, because there's different aspects. And what our sages do, or the different commentaries have different approaches, they show different different aspects so that you could learn from the different aspects to know how to deal with God, or if it's in a different area, how to deal with life. It's the area of Musa. Just a clarification. In other words, by Chana, she had a selfish desire to have children. That's definitely, we're human beings, and we have our personal desires, and we have a right to pray to God. But what we do is we put it in the God's framework or God's system, so that that gets us closer to God. When we start living and working our life out according to God's system, that brings us closer to God. So when I pray to God and I use God's system in my prayer, that brings me closer to God. But the original cause for the prayer was Hannah's personal desire. Otherwise, again about Hannah. When Hannah, what we term blackmail God, in other words, that she used the system, there's one thing that you have to understand, that Hannah recognized that she must live by the system. And it's not just a magical formula. It's not just that God relates to you magically somehow to you, but there's a system. And Hannah's greatness is that she recognized that she must relate to God through a system. I mean, even when God said that the firstborn of every household will die, and the only way, he made a rule that you must stay in your house and you must have the blood of the Paschal Lamb on your doorway. Now, if somebody walked out of the house and he was the firstborn, he would die. It's a system. God relates to us through a system. We have a legal system, which is our relationship to God. And from that we learn that God relates to us through systems. You understand? And if we understand these systems, then we know how to relate to God. But the first thing is, you must recognize that God relates to you through a system. That's what Hannah understood. And so therefore, she used the system. So that shows a certain closeness to God. That is not, in other words, it sounds like she's a selfish person and just using the system for her own benefit. It sounds, and it is true, she is doing that. But the fact is, she's on a close level to God because she recognizes that God relates to us through systems, and therefore, to reach out to God, you must have, you must relate through the system. Okay, the question is, what does the Gemara mean when it says everything is the hand of God except the fear of God? Where is free choice? Does this limit God's power? Why is fear of God the exception? Right. The answer is, first of all, the question is, where's free choice? That is exactly free choice. Free choice is only insofar as your fear of God. You have a choice to relate to God or not to relate to God. Okay? And therefore, that is exactly free choice. But I'd like to clarify fear of God. Okay? Most people say fear of God is like the people have a religious emotion, and that religious emotion tells them to fear God, you see. Now, we see from the world around us that that a lot of people have this religious emotion, and they fear different gods, you see. So the religious emotion, like any other emotion, is good, except not in the extreme. Okay, you have to be careful. Religious emotion is a good thing. But however, religious emotion should not dictate who God is, how God relates to us, or how we relate to God. You see? So therefore, all the religious emotion should dictate is that we should study the Torah so that we should learn this information. It's the Torah that has to tell us who is God, how does God relate to us, and how should we relate to God. That is fear of... Now, the question is, so then we have to check within the Torah, what is fear of God? Okay, of the three things that we mentioned, we only want to know what is fear of God. Okay, in other words, we said three things. We said basically that the Torah should tell us who is God, the Torah should tell us how God relates to us, and how we should relate to God. Now, all these is very lengthy. I mean, there are books written on all three. We're just taking one aspect, namely, how we should... the fear of God. In other words, what is fear of God? Okay? Now, the thing is that there is something called consequences. Okay? And a person in his everyday life must evaluate the consequences of all his acts. Okay? So, for instance, a person would not cross the street blindfolded in a busy street because that would not be conducive to his health. So, therefore, he would not do it because the consequences would be bad. Our relationship with God is only in areas where I don't have the ability to operate. For instance, Rashi says about Yaakov when he met Esav. So he says that when he sent all the animals, that was a peace treaty. Then he divided the camp, so Rashi said he prepared for war. The third thing is he prayed to God. Okay, so he prayed to God that he did everything he can, but there are circumstances that is not in his control. Maybe the army is better, maybe they have better terrain. You understand, there might be different factors that he would not be able to win. So therefore, it is in that area that he turns to God. Okay? So therefore, fear over here is a certain rational. In other words, it's where I'm afraid of consequences that are out of my hands. That is where I turn to God. For instance, throughout the Torah, where it talks about the blessings that we would get if we keep the Torah and the consequences or curses that we keep if we don't keep the Torah. Okay, so that's fear of God. For instance, there's another good example of fear of God. The society, how the society works, when it will affect my life. For instance, in the 80s and 90s, it was practically impossible to lose money on the stock market. And then suddenly the stock market plunged, where people, without any warning, people were wiped out. All their savings, everything they put in, when they first went in, they put in $10,000, $20,000, and then then they became worth $300,000, $500,000. I mean, the stock market went up. They made money. Then suddenly it collapsed. They were practically wiped out. You see, that's totally out of their hands. See, so how the society affects you is also an area that you could pray to God, because that is an area that is out of your hands. You could think through to the best of your ability what to do with your money, but you can't know, there's no way of really knowing the future. And that is the area that you can pray to God, because it's out of your hands. Now, if you live this way and you truly see this idea, because you start as you start living it, then you will really see how much you are truly dependent on God for your existence, and how much your existence is very little is really in your hands. This brings you closer to God, but it's still based on a certain selfishness, my success or failure. It is not based on a direct, just relationship to God. That is a higher level. That's called love of God or awe of God. That's a higher level, and that's the study of Tehillim. Tehillim Psalms talks about that in more detail, how to be directly related to God and do things only because of the will of God. That does not mean you do not pray to God when you're in trouble. I mean, the stories in the Torah of the greats, how they prayed to God and asked God for their help. Like I just told you about the story of Jacob. But, so it doesn't mean you don't turn to God, but your relationship to God, your motivation, there's a change in motivation. First motivation is my relationship to God is only what I could get out of him, either to protect me or to give me benefit. The higher level is I relate to God because I relate to the source of all wisdom. That is a subject in and of itself, and that subject is in the book of Psalms. I'm just putting on the lower level helps you understand how little you are in control of your own life. When you look around and start thinking about the areas that you do have control and the areas that you don't have control, you see how much you are truly dependent on God in practically all areas. Okay? And that is the lower level. But it must come through a recognition, the realistic recognition, that there is very little that I'm in control of in my life. Then afterwards, you could start the study of Tehillim, helps you relate to God directly. A student wrote and asked a question like this. The issue is free choice. A person is born into an environment which inevitably affects his emotions and the decisions that he makes. If this is true, then how can a person be accountable for his decisions? Decisions which are for the most part out of control. The person asked me this question in regards to learning. He wanted to know why he should be responsible for choosing not to learn. If that decision really came from his society and for the fact that no one ever introduced him to the world of ideas in Torah. Related to the above question, he also wanted to know why some people choose to learn and develop intellectually and other people don't. Does this decision stem from one's surroundings and upbringing? If so, then how can we be accountable? Okay? That is the question which the student wrote. Okay? The first thing I'd like to say is that there is a big argument in the world of philosophy whether there is free will or not. And I don't know if it has been proven. If it has, I don't know of it, but so I don't know of any proof from the outside world, from the world of science, that if there is free will or not. And your question is based on that your knowledge of the world, basically that people, the environment affect you, so therefore it seems like there's no free will. That observation is absolutely true. But however, we accept Torah and we accept that there is an idea of free will, that God could not have given a Torah which you must obey if you don't have free will to obey him. So therefore, we must accept free will. And my view is that free will lies not in everyday action, but it lies in decisions that affects the course of your life, and whether you will make a decision of wisdom or a decision based on your feelings, and that there is free will. And that people do have that free will according to Torah. Okay? But I do not have a proof for one way over the other. I have no proof. And superficially it does look like there is no free will. But however, I must accept the Torah that there is free will, that a person does have free will, and I believe that the area of free will is choosing to live an intelligent life based on the mind that you see truth, and a life of justice, because you see that justice is good. And there are people, whether in the world of Torah or outside of Torah, that have made these decisions. But you could always claim that it was their upbringing. You could always claim that. That's true. Like I'm saying, there is no proof. I have no proof. But however, that is where free will lies. However, I'd like to give a second approach. That is this. Even if you do not hold from free will, even if you hold free will does not exist, practically, you have no choice but to think things through to make decisions. In other words, you're going to go into business. Are you just going to, buy stocks? Are you just going to buy stocks without looking at the company and throw a dart at all the companies that you could invest in, and whichever it falls, that's where you buy? Or do you investigate how the stock is going and the history and what they're doing and their ways of investigating or going into a business? Person investigates. Or if you're going to go to a certain profession, what profession you could do could be investigated. What is better at this time? What is the best type of... what's the best type of... You can't live without investigation unless you become a beach bum and just move out to the beach. But however, if you're going to live a normal life, then you must make even the decision to whether you're going to become a beach bum or live in society, that should also be thought out beforehand. It is practically, it's impossible to live life without making decisions. So therefore, even if I don't have a philosophical proof for free will, practically, it is impossible to live without free will. In other words, the question was whether I should choose to learn or not. Well, let's investigate the life of learning or not the life of learning. So you'll say that that's not free will where I investigate. So that might be true, but the fact is that practically you cannot live without investigating, and you can't give up that idea of investigating all possibilities, or not you're going to come to terrible consequences that we could show. In other words, like this. When your car breaks down, do you kick it? Or do you call the mechanic, right? That's your choice, you see. Now, you must make choices, you see. So therefore, practically, you have no way out but to make choices, even if there's no free will. What I mean is that if there's no free will, you could prove that there is no such thing as free will philosophically, you must live as if, practically, you must live as if there is free will. Now, you might argue to me that, yeah, but the person that does think didn't have free choice in his thinking, and the person that doesn't think didn't have free choice in his decision. that happens to be true if you hold that there is no free will. That happens to be true, but the person that doesn't investigate his life will come to terrible consequences. But however, the person that does investigate his life will have good results, will have better results. So therefore, I say that a thinking person cannot live with that as if there is no free will, even if he proves that there is no free will. Okay, the subject matter that we're going to discuss today is strategy. Okay? Now, in the Torah, we have different types of strategy, and we're going to try to take out the different principles of strategy. I mean, of course, you're not going to come across the same situation. Like today's strategy is of war. You're not going to have the same situation. But however, the principles, you'll see, you'll train yourself how to make strategy, so then you can do it in your own life, too. Basically, we're going to see two principles here. One principle that we'll see through this strategy is you must be able to maneuver and be creative to use all the whole situation, every aspect of the situation, to be able to use it for your advantage. You have to analyze all the components of the situation and also to make sure you know what components are in the situation. Sometimes you might think, oh, this is really not, but really it is. You have to know to be very creative and use things in an unusual way. Two is that success comes in any strategy. If one point is missing, the whole strategy, the result which you want, could fail. So you must fill up every gap that you can't fail on any one point. Every point must be carried out. In other words, you must recognize whenever there is a gap that could make you fail, you must make sure to fill that gap, because it's not the whole plan, it's any point in the plan. It's not the whole plan together, but each point is the weakest link. That the strength of a chain is its weakest link. Okay, in the Judges, that Shoftim Gimel, that Judges 3, verse 15, it says, "And the children of Israel cried to God, and God set up to them a savior, a benefactor, and his name was Ehud ben Gera. He was from the tribe of Benjamin." Now, the ultimate plan is that they're going to kill the king. They were under a king, and his name was Eglon, and they wanted to kill Eglon, and so to make the nation in disarray. Okay. Now the first thing is that this Ehud had a withered right hand. Okay. Now psychologically, when you see a cripple, there's a certain thing that you feel that, like, you feel secure with him. You feel stronger than him, even though it might not be true, but emotionally, the unconscious looks at it, you feel secure with that guy, even though in reality it's not so. So we use that quality to make them feel secure with Ehud, that the king could be with Ehud and not be afraid of him. That was the first step of the strategy. Then they also sent a present. Now you have to understand that people want to believe that they're the greatest. Now, the Jews served Eglon for 18 years. And he probably thought he's a great king, you see. So when they sent him a present, then he feels, psychologically, he feels that I'm doing a good job and they really recognize me. He would not think that they're trying to trick me, you see? Even though sometimes some kings would, some kings wouldn't, you understand? their emotions take over. You have to know the opponent who you're dealing with, if he's a skeptic or if he's a person that's so self-centered that he can't, when somebody is nice to him, so he feels they're doing, it really is true. Because they believe that, so of course everybody must believe that. So therefore, he trusts them even more when they bring a present and they're saying he's doing a good job as a king, and we're thankful to him. And he believes that. You see? So therefore, every con artist is based on this idea. Now, just one thing here, that is, in a just cause, we're allowed to use a lot of tricks, psychological tricks that con artists use or evil people use. You have to know when it's just and when it's unjust. Okay? But the thing is, we could use a lot of strategy for a good cause. Okay? So you have to be careful that you don't use it for, if you learn strategy, that you don't use it for an evil cause. You have to make sure the cause that you're doing for is just. Okay, now the next step is verse 16. He made a sword, he made a two-edged sword. Now the thing is that he had to kill him very quickly. And that there should be no outcry because he's going to be in the palace and he didn't want to get caught. So he had to sharpen it from both sides to make sure that it goes in easy, smoothly, and quickly so that there's no outcry and he dies very quickly. And he also shortened it to a foot and a half to 2 feet. I'm not sure the exact amount. Called an amma in Hebrew. Difference of opinion whether an amma is a foot and a half or 2 feet. But anyway, so it could fit under his cloak and it doesn't show out when he comes into the king. I guess in those days they didn't do any searching. But especially if they had a crippled hand, so they wouldn't worry too much about such a guy, and he's bringing a present, he's showing subservience to the king. So he didn't show any type of belligerence or aggression, so I guess they trusted him, you see. So he had the thing. Now, in those days, the swords were very long. So sometimes you have to change for your situation the way things are used in your society. You might have to change the object to fit into your strategy. That's where you have to be creative. Okay? And then he tied it under his cloak, and it says here in the verse that he put it on his right side. The right side was his withered hand, so it's easier to grab, stretch out your hand from the other side, draw the sword, so you could easily draw it with his left hand, so therefore he put it by his right side, because he would have to do it with the left hand. Okay, then he brings the present to Eglon, and then it says Eglon is extremely fat. Okay, now we'll soon see where this factor also plays a role in the strategy. Okay, that will come to in a few minutes. Okay, now when they finished the present, and the nation went away. The nation, there was a group, by the nation it means he went with a group of people to give honor to the king. You don't go with one person, you go with a whole group of people. That shows a tremendous amount of honor. Now, they went until they reached a certain place called, which were the quarries of Gilgal, and then he returned by himself. The reason for this is that it's easier to one person to escape than for many people to escape. By the way, I just want to mention that all my interpretations are coming from one of two commentaries, either the Ralbag, you can find it in the Ralbag, or the Metsudos, basically from those two commentaries. Okay? So anyway, so therefore he left, he made sure they were in a safe situation where they could get away. So he left them, and he went back himself And he says, I have a secret to tell the king, a personal thing for the king. And the king tells him, quiet, don't say anything until everybody leaves. And everybody that was by the king left. You know, all the people that stood in front of the king that was by the king. Now, once they left, and Ehud had to get closer to him, so at that point, Ehud comes closer to him, and they were sitting in a porch. It was a cool place where there were open windows, so it was totally separated from the rest of the palace, so if there is any outcry, there's a chance that it won't be heard. And they were alone because everybody left, and then Ehud said, I have a word of God to you. In other words, I have a prophecy that God told me that I have to tell you. Now, Ehud stood up from the throne. In other words, in honor of God, he got up because he was going to hear prophecy of God. He got up from the throne. Okay? Eglon got up. I'm sorry, not Ehud. Eglon got up. Now, when a very, very heavy person has to rise, he's involved with getting up. He can't notice things around him. In that situation, see, here's where the fat came in, because he knew that if he gets up, he's going to be involved in the getting up and he wouldn't notice. And at that point, Ehud, with his left hand, grabs the sword from the right side and he sticks it into his stomach, and also the hilt came into all the way down. He was so fat that the fat he went all around the hilt, and the reason why it covered the hilt was totally covered by the fat, and the reason why he went so far in is because he had to get the vital parts of him and not just the fat, so he could die. So he had to get the sword in. In other words, the sword was cut short because of that was the only way to sneak it into the palace. But then when he stuck it in, there's a weakness there because it might not get, by the time it gets through the fat, it won't get the vital parts. So therefore he had to push it all the way in straight into the hilt also, you see, to make sure he got the vital parts, okay? All right. The question is why does the verses go into so much detail, right? I think it goes into so much detail because making strategy in life is a very essential part of life. You must, whatever you're doing, there must be a plan and there must be strategy of how to carry out the plan, every aspect of the plan. And in every plan that the Torah shows us, they show us, one is the plan, exactly how all the things at that situation, everything that can be used to benefit the plan is used, and two is that there's no weak link in the chain of events, you see? And as you go over, the more you review, and the more cases you have, then it becomes part of you. The purpose of this is not to remember this or that fact. The purpose is to make sure the mind sees every step and how he used every aspect of the situation and how he had to make sure of every aspect, and every time you review it, it becomes part of you. Because you're never going to be in such a situation as Ehud. But what you do need from here is to see how strategy and planning work. And therefore, they go into every detail to help you, for your sake, to help you work it out in your life. Now, also, you have to notice that every word that the verse says is not just for nothing. Everything with the commentaries point out is just not a story, but it's there for the understanding of what it has to do with the strategy, you see. So the next thing is he didn't take the sword out. Now the question is, why does the Torah mention that? And the answer is that if he pulled it out, then the blood might come out, and he'd get bloody, and then it would be noticed when he left. So you have to make sure that no blood comes over out of him. So therefore, also when the hilt went all the way in, it stopped the blood from spurting out and getting over him. So therefore, that was very important. Okay? And also, when it came out, the excrement came out also, because it went all the way down through the stomach, all the way into the bowels. And so the excrement came out, and the reason why it stated there, we'll soon see that that's also part of the plan, that this was part of the plan. Anyway, Ehud left the supper chamber, and he closed the door, and he locked it. There seems to have been a key on the outside, and he locked it. And he left, and he left. And his servants came to see, you know, to go back to the king when they saw Ehud left, and the doors were locked, and they say he's probably in the bed, he's probably relieving himself, because there was a certain odor. You see? So the certain odor made them feel that, okay, so he's relieving himself, so they'll wait. And they waited for a long time. And they never opened the door. The king never said anything. He didn't open it. So finally they took the key and they opened the door, and their master, the king, was dead on the floor. But by the time they did that, Ehud was able to escape. While they were waiting, he was able to make his escape, and since it was one person alone, it was very, very quick. And he passed again, it says he passed again the border, the danger seems to have been where it would be safe already, the quarries, and he escaped to the place called Seir. Now, when he came there, he blew on the shofar. He knew things. Now, the plan was that things had to go very fast. If this was successful, see, if it failed and you gather an army, so then the army is going to be wiped out. But if it fails and no army is together, you see, so they say it's an individual rebel that worked it out, and that's it, but it's not the nation. So they had to protect themselves in case the nation, in case he fails. You see, they had to work on that. So therefore, they didn't have the army ready, but they knew to be prepared when the signal came. And so therefore, he blew on the shofar on Mount Ephraim, and the nation of Israel followed with